Great swing, Dad. What's your secret?
It's no secret, Pumpkin. It's Provisil. Dr. Muscovy said it would make everything better, and boy, was he right.
Provisil. What's it for?
I don't actually know. But as long as I'm shooting below par, I'm not gonna ask.
Sounds great. You think old Doc Muscovy would prescribe some Provisil for me?
Mind you, I'm no doctor. But the way I see it, Provisil's good for everybody, so far as I know.
But as you said, you're not a doctor.
That's right, Pumpkin. I'm just an ordinary guy who takes a lot of drugs.
And golfs like a son of a bitch.
Provisil is not for everyone. Consult a physician before taking Provisil. Do not take Provisil if you ingest food on a daily basis. Side effects may include nausea, vomiting, headaches, stomach cramps, dizziness, confusion, liver and kidney failure, hemorrhaging, loss of mental acuity, diarrhea, shortness of breath, chest pains, swollen testicles, irritated bowel, pigeon toes, respiratory inflammation, permanent blindness, loss of sexual motivation, pancreatic dysfunction, goggle eyes, polio, and temporary darkening of the stool.
Digital Flotsam is made possible by the generous support of the Robert Wood Johnson Company, makers of prosthetic Wood Johnsons for more than half a century. Because nothing feels better than wood.
Hi, this is Dick Sloogie, and here's another great story by Pete Up.
Welcome to another edition of Digital Flotsam. I'm P.W. Fenton. Regular listeners may recall an episode where I related some stories from one of my former professions, that of a cop. I called that episode War Stories, after the nickname given such tales by cops who hang out together after work, drinking beers, and sharing their most interesting experiences. Well, I've decided to dip into that well again and share a few more amazing but true stories about life on the job, only this time I will tell mostly tales about training rookie cops. And in an effort to exceed the creativity of the original show title, I've decided to call this one More War Stories. His name was Tony. He was Italian. He was young, good-looking, and most importantly, really bright and well-educated. In fact, he was so sharp that I didn't quite understand how I got him. I usually got the ones that were dumb as rocks. This guy was a real pleasure. During the first phase of on-the-job training, the rookie's job is basically to observe. The field instructor handles most of the calls as though he was alone. The rookie is there just to look on, but he can take notes for the report writing part of the job. But during the call, his job is to just try and look like a cop while the FTO handles the call, and maybe offer a hand if things get rough and physical. The first few nights went pretty well. He stayed out of my way when we were on calls, and his note-taking and report-writing skills far exceeded the normal rookie. I was starting to feel really lucky.
I'm lucky, I'm lucky, I'm lucky, I'm lucky. I'm lucky, I'm lucky, I'm lucky, I'm lucky. I'm lucky you left me, I think I'm better off this way. I'm lucky you left me, although I wanted you to stay. Left me, I don't cry a lot at night. I'm lucky you left me, don't worry darling, I'm alright. When first you went away, I thought my days and nights were forever gonna suck. But now with just a little bit of time, I can feel my future brightening up. 'Cause the truth is,
field instructors, because they have an evil streak, generally try to volunteer for the worst calls in an effort to see how their rookies will react. If something sounds bloody or gross and disgusting, a field instructor will jump on that call just to see if his rookie can handle it. That, after all, is a big part of police work. So when I heard a nearby dead body call go out, I grabbed the mic and volunteered to handle it. The cop who was assigned to it was more than happy to give it up. It was going to be a real good one. The person who had called it in hadn't seen their neighbor for days, and upon going into the house, found her quite dead. I should warn you right now that what we found might even be difficult for someone to listen to. So if you think you're that person, go listen to something else. I should say that personally, I hated these types of calls. They were always horrible. A human body that has been dead for days smells awful. No, that's wrong. It's beyond awful. It's a smell that you can't forget. It's a smell that doesn't go away for days. You can go home at the end of the day, take off your uniform and burn it, take a 2-hour shower, and you still smell it. It's like it actually becomes part of your nose. Well, when we arrived at this house, the person who made the gruesome discovery was there waiting for us. When I asked him to lead us to the body, he just pointed at the front door and said, "In the bedroom. If you don't mind, I'm not going back in there." Internally, not visibly, of course, I was grinning ear to ear. This was going to be a good one. I could feel it. I turned to my rookie, who as yet hadn't handled a call on his own, and said, "Okay, this one is all yours." I'm sure he knew he was getting it because it was a bad call and I was going to enjoy his misery, but he walked right into the house without protest, with me right behind. It was one of those railroad-type houses where all the rooms are in a row, where you can walk in a straight line from the front door, through the living room, through the dining room, through the bedroom, through the kitchen, and out the back door. We walked through a nicely kept old house. Old furniture matched the old-looking rooms. And when we made it into the bedroom, it was clear why we were here. It smelled absolutely awful. Maybe the worst I've ever smelled in my entire life. A rather overweight woman had gotten up from bed because she thought she was having a heart attack. Perhaps she was heading to the phone. She never made it. She collapsed and fell on the floor with her face pressed up against an electric space heater that was still on. She had been dead for days, and she was therefore partially cooked. I warned you. This was rookie gold. This was the worst call I personally had ever been on, ever. The worst thing I had ever smelled, ever. I immediately got on the radio to all my fellow field instructors and suggested that they come by with their rookies. They all eagerly complied. While poor Tony dutifully took care of this call, a steady parade of amused veterans and grossed-out rookies paraded through the scene. Several rookies ran out the front door and vomited in the street. The veterans thanked me for my consideration. Finally, the company that specializes in disposing of dead bodies arrived and, with great dignity and aplomb, placed the woman on a gurney and began to strap her down. As they pulled the strap tight on the midsection of the body, it let out a sound that anyone would identify as a huge fart. Instantly, the room filled with a smell different than the one that had already been there. I earlier described this particular scene as the worst I had ever smelled in my entire life, and that includes the time, again, as a police officer, that I fell through the rotted cover of a cesspool. This was way, way, way worse. I very casually turned and strolled slowly into the kitchen that had been situated behind me. Using every ounce of strength I had to appear calm and collected, I opened the back door and leaned my head outside as though I was looking to see what might be in the backyard. A huge arc of puke shot from my face. Although my body wanted to writhe and convulse, I stayed as still as possible while this was happening. When it was over, I stepped back into the kitchen, picked up a glass from the drain board, and had a little drink of water. I walked back through the now empty house. I finally found Tony, my rookie, on his knees on the front lawn, his body convulsing. I waited till he was through, and then he got back in the car with me. He looked at me through bloodshot eyes and said, "How could you stay in there?" I looked at him with a sneer and said, "Why? Too much for you?" Like all rookies, he thought I was superhuman. I thought my field instructor was superhuman. I thought he could read minds. It happens to every rookie. I continued to ride with Tony, and I'll never forget that one day I spotted a guy on the sidewalk that just seemed he was up to no good. No real information, it was just a feeling. I pulled the car over and told Tony to field interview the guy. A field interview involves just identifying a subject and writing everything down in a short report. Remarkably, these little short reports get linked up to nearby crimes and solve lots of cases. Well, Tony got out of the car and started reluctantly interviewing the guy. I know that Tony felt like I had stopped a totally innocent man and couldn't understand why he even needed to be bothered, but Tony routinely called in his name and date of birth on the radio for a records check. Within a few minutes, the dispatcher called him back and said, "Subject returns a valid warrant for Signal 23 from..." Before that sentence was even finished, this guy just took off and was running down the street. Now, a field instructor never runs and tackles a bad guy. That's the rookie's job. And most rookies are eager to do anything that amounts to real action. So you could imagine my dismay when my rookie just looked at me quizzically like, "What should I do now?" I turned and looked towards the guy who was already too far for me to even reasonably think either of us could catch him, and in complete frustration grabbed my nightstick and just threw it. I was so mad at my worthless rookie. Much to my amazement, the nightstick bounced on the sidewalk once, twice, like a skipping stone, and then landed right in between the bad guy's feet, tripping him and sending him face first into the sidewalk. I turned to the rookie, like I planned it, and said, "Cuff him." Within one day, every rookie in the department knew of my superpowers. When in fact I totally threw it out of frustration, not even aiming at the guy, and instantly thinking to myself, "Oh, that was stupid, now I have to go get it." Well, that day, the day after the nightstick trick, we broke roll call and were getting ready to hit the street. We had reached the point where Tony was about to start handling all the calls, and more importantly, driving the car. My job was to sit quietly in the passenger seat observing and reporting. He knew my routine by now. We'd get in the car, drive straight to the garage, fill up the gas tank, drive through the automated car wash, and then drive to our assigned area, and possibly stop and buy some coffee along the way. He gassed us up, got back in the car, and drove towards the car wash. He had been acting especially nervous, so I was paying pretty close attention to everything he was doing. As he aimed our front wheels into the track that would lead us through the car wash, I could see that he hadn't closed his window. It was so obvious, though, that I hesitated to remind him for fear I would shake his confidence even more. He pulled right up to the point where the front of the car would trigger the nozzles to start spraying water on us. So I couldn't wait any longer. I shouted, "Whoa!" This totally startled him, and he reacted by pushing down the accelerator at first, and then shifting his foot and jamming on the brake. The net result was that the car lurched forward into the car wash, and then stopped right where the water nozzles were lined up with his open window. By the time he realized what was wrong and closed his window, we were both soaked to the skin. Needless to say, every living cop knew this story by the end of the shift. The next day at roll call, I learned Tony had resigned. He had left me a note thanking me and saying that he had made the difficult decision that police work just wasn't for him. He was the most educated rookie I ever had, the guy I thought was going to be the easiest to get through the process, but it just wasn't for him. The next rookie I was assigned was almost the exact opposite of Tony. He wanted to be the police more than anything in the world, and thoroughly believed he would succeed. But he was the craziest and stupidest bastard I had ever encountered in my life.
I've been bashed and battered and bruised and beaten. I've been abused, misused, and I've been mistreated. I've been up and down, and still I feel you're an asshole. And I've looked at it from your side, and I've looked at it from mine. And I know you had a hard time when you were only nine. Long ago, and now there's just no denying that you're an asshole. You're an asshole. You're an asshole. Yeah, 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 yeah. You're an asshole.
He had everything going against him. He was about 5'10 and weighed, oh, maybe 85 pounds. I mean, we're talking skinny. Nothing he wore seemed to fit him. No matter what he did, everything just looked sloppy. He had pale skin and fine blonde hair, and he wore glasses in tortoise shell frames that made his eyes look like BBs. His total appearance demanded disrespect. And to top it all off, his name, his last name, his real last name was, I can't even say it, Schmidgey. Can you imagine walking up to someone who has a serious crime to report and saying, "Good morning, I'm Officer Fenton, and this is Officer Schmidgey." I said that to a biker once, and he just doubled over laughing. Well, one night I pulled over a car, making an illegal turn, just to give Schmidgey a little solo experience. I purposely picked out a car with a normal-looking family in it, two adults and a kid in the back seat. My plan was to let him go up to the car by himself, collect the license and registration, and come back to the patrol car. If he could complete that much, I would feel happy, and I would tell him just to give back the stuff and tell the people to drive carefully. After a minute or two at the driver's door, he walked back to the car holding the license and registration, opened the passenger door to the patrol car, and sat next to me. He then said these words, which I will never forget.
"I know that this is going to sound hard to believe. I don't know how they did it, but I think they have your handcuffs."
There was a long silence. I had never left the driver's seat of the car. I couldn't think of what in the world to ask him first. In total disbelief, I said, "Schmidgey, why do you think they have my handcuffs?"
"Because when they opened the glove box, I saw them in there, I think."
"My handcuffs?"
"Yep."
"Not your handcuffs?"
"Nope." Mine are right here.
He reached around and unsnapped the case and proudly held his handcuffs up for me to see. I said, Schmidgy, give me the license and registration. He did. And then I said, stay right there. Don't get out of the car under any circumstances. I walked up to the family, handed them back their stuff, and wished them a nice day. Schmidgy was so wrong for the job. I kept wondering how he could have ever made it through the academy. It was the scariest time I have ever spent as a police officer. I constantly felt like something would go horribly wrong. It was the only time in my career that I avoided calls, where my goal would simply be to last the day and go home in one piece. But I still would feel guilty, like I wasn't giving him a chance, like I wasn't trying to help him succeed. And whenever I started to feel guilty, I would try to come up with something really simple and easy for him to do, so he at least wouldn't feel like I was deliberately keeping him out of everything, which I usually was. Riding up the interstate, I saw a car parked on the shoulder with a woman standing behind it with a trunk lid open. So I put myself out on an assist motorist call. What could be easier? With any luck at all, we'd just be sitting in our car waiting for an hour for a AAA wrecker to come and tow our car. The woman explained that she thought she was out of gas and was looking in the trunk for a gas can. I quickly determined that she probably was indeed out of gas and offered to give her a lift to the nearest gas station where we would borrow a can from the manager that I knew and get a gallon of gas so she could drive to a gas station. It was one of those stations with a long line of pumps and a small store in the center where you could buy snacks and beer and soda. And as I parked on one side of the store, I tried to think of what would go wrong if I let Schmidgy handle this himself. I pictured him putting the nozzle into the can and squeezing the handle and having it spray back on him because he neglected to open the vent. So as he got out of the car with the lady that we were helping, I said, hey, be sure to open the little vent cap on the back end of the can before you start pumping. He looked at me as if to say, what do you think, I'm stupid? Silently, I thought to myself, yes. He went off into the store. I busied myself with some paperwork. I don't know how long it actually was before it dawned on me that he still hadn't come out of the store with the can. I tried to imagine what the problem could be as I started to open my door and get out to check on him. My imagination, however, was not up to Schmidgy standards. At the very moment I was getting out of the patrol car, the manager came bursting out of the store running towards me. Officer, please, you've got to stop him. He's already pumped $5 worth of gas, and it's everywhere. I'm afraid there's going to be an explosion. I looked around and said, where is he? On the other side. Hurry, stop him. I ran through the store, and when I opened the door on the other side, the first thing I saw was the frightened look on the face of the lady we were supposed to be helping. She was standing right next to the door. I looked towards the pumps. There he was, squatting down over the red plastic can in the middle of a giant puddle of gasoline. The puddle had to be 30 feet wide, and he's pumping a steady stream of gas onto the can, and it's running all over. I screamed, Schmidgy, what the hell are you doing? He stopped pumping, looked up at me and smiled and said, now I know why you didn't want to do this. This is hard. That little hole is way too small. But it's almost full. Just as I had told him, he had opened the little plastic vent cap before filling the can through the tiny little vent opening and was about to resume filling it. I screamed, stop! I looked at him in total disbelief. I was almost unable to speak. You don't see that fucking lake of gasoline? He looked up and said, the hole is too small. What was I supposed to do? My face turned bright red, and I screamed, how about nothing! At that moment, the fire trucks began to arrive with sirens wailing. That night, I couldn't sleep. All I could do was imagine what might have happened if I had simply continued to be absorbed in my paperwork and the gas station manager had never looked out the door after wondering how more than $5 worth of gas was being pumped into a 1 gallon plastic jug. There would have been nothing but a crater left there at Florida and Linebaugh. There would have been an empty coffin at my funeral because there was nothing left to bury. And nobody would have ever known how it happened. The next day, I called in sick. I made it clear to my sergeant that I would probably be sick until I no longer had to ride with Schmidgey. And that same day, my sergeant did the dirty work and convinced Schmidgey that it would be better to resign than to be fired. So there you have it, another episode of Digital Flotsam. If you're sitting there thinking that this story had to be fiction, I'm not offended. I totally understand. It seems impossible to me, too. Be sure to check out the show notes at digitalflotsam.org for links to all the great music you've heard in this show. And now, a familiar voice reminds you that...
P-Dub, hold the microphone.
Okay, hold it. Don't skip this part. This isn't an advertisement. Well, it is kind of an advertisement, but it's an advertisement for an upcoming Digital Flotsam. You see, I had an idea. Whenever I do a show like this, I'm faced with searching for PodSafe music to include in it. Well, my idea was simple. What if I came up with an idea for a Digital Flotsam, and then I approach some talented folks and ask them to contribute original music for it? You know, folks like Monk, folks like Don Miceli and Paul Bland, Smitten Bayou, folks like Mike Errico. Well, it's coming together, and it's coming soon. And who knows, maybe it'll be a trend. Maybe this is a cool new idea for how to do shows like this. Keep your ears ready. The first such experiment is coming soon. Some of the music is already written and recorded, and I think it's going to be great. Can't wait.